Okay, this is supposed to be an introduction to non-standard descriptive set theory. I think I'm going to be focusing mostly on really non-standard analysis, and at the end I'll do a little bit of basics of the non-standard descriptive set theory. If you have any questions, you can interrupt. I'll try to entertain questions. That doesn't mean I'll be able to answer them, though. I don't know. Okay. So we're going to be starting with what we call a ground set, X naught. It has to. We want it to contain the reals. We can usually think of it as being a set of reals. If we ever need to throw anything else in, we'll just allow that possibility. But usually, it will be a set of reals. So we call the elements of the set. Elements of this set should be individual points and not sets. So we're kind of leaving the usual set theoretic way of speaking of things where everything is a set. The elements of the x0 are actually points. So we don't want to have to start having the possibility of these elements being sets with other things in them and intersecting with other things. They'll just be their own individual points. Anyway, we're going to build up a hierarchy. So x1 is the power set of x0, and any x plus any xn plus 1 is just the power set of x to the n. So yeah, we'll have sets of reals and so on. And what we end up with once we do this is we see that we have xn every xn is a subset of xn plus 1, that's for n greater than or equal to 1, but the x0 is disjoint from all the others. Again, the x0 is the point and everything else, oh, I did that wrong, sorry. This is the union, the power set of the union from 0 to n of the xn. So what we actually have here is x1 is a subset of the reals. X1 is a set of subsets of reals. After that, we take subsets of all the previous ones that we've had and put them all together. Subsets of everything that we've had previously. So xn is contained in xn plus 1 once we get past the first stage, but none of these actually contain individual real numbers. So then we're going to define our big set X to be the union of all these Xn's. And, it's natural, of course. And this is going to be called the superstructure over the ground set X0. So this is just kind of building up a starting point. We have a superstructure called X. Sometimes they use a script X, but I'm never going to use the regular capital X for anything else, so we'll just keep it with capital X. So again, the idea is we have these sort of individual elements and the subsets that are in it, and the idea, and we're going to think of this as a model for all of classical analysis. So really, it's actually X with element of and equals. This can be used. These elements can be used to write down any classical analytical statement. So let's just do a couple of brief examples of that to show that that works. So if we have any two real numbers, we know that the ordered pair can be defined as, this is one of those things that you see once and then forget about and nobody really cares about it, but this is the formal definition of an ordered pair, x, y, and well, what is this in? Because we have, this is a subset of the reals, this is another subset of the reals, we have a collection of subsets of the reals, so we're in our x2, and therefore in our model sort of thing, x here. Similarly, the entire R2 is a collection of such ordered pairs, so it's a subset of the set of all these things which are in x2, so it's in x3, and any function is simply a collection of some ordered pairs, obviously not all. So any function real value function is also in x3. And as another little example, continuous functions. So if we think of the set of continuous functions, we're taking a collection of elements that are in x3, so that thing is in x4. These are just some basic examples just to show the basic idea that anything analytic, any analytic statement, any analytic concept in classical analysis can be represented using this model. And of course, all ordinary arithmetic operations are functions, usually from R2 to R or whatever they are, so they all fit within this model also. Okay, so we want to be able to build up some non-standard models, and they are going to be what we call these superstructure extensions. So here we have a superstructure that we started with. We're going to build somehow a superstructure extension. And to do that, we're going to define ultra powers on the superstructure X with respect to a certain ultra filter. So what we'll do is, starting here, okay, let U be an ultra filter over N. In general, it actually doesn't have to be over the naturals, and there may be some cases where, in fact, it's better to not use the naturals, but for this, we'll just stick to the naturals. It doesn't really make that much difference. So we want U to be actually to be a non-principal ultra filter. Non-principal ultra filter or free ultra filter, whatever, same thing. And we know that exists from other techniques. So let U be a non-principal ultra filter over the naturals, and then we're going to use that in a moment, and we'll see what we get to. So consider our sequences of elements in our set X, in our structure X. This is taking this product set is sort of the first step in getting to our superstructure or superstructure extension. The problem is that this is too big. This is bigger than we want it to be. There are too many sequences in here. So we want to create an equivalence relation and do something to shrink this down a little bit. So, all right. So for F and G sequences of elements of X, we will define an equivalence relation. Define F equivalent to G if, and here we have N we say that F and G are equivalent if they're equal on a set in the ultra filter. Is there a name for elements of an ultra filter? Because I'm going to use that all the time, it just gets wordy. Anyway, all right. So F is equivalent to G if it's equal on a set which is in the ultra filter. Equal, we'll call it almost everywhere, borrowing terms from other areas. Okay. F is equivalent to G if it's equal almost everywhere. Fine. That'll be the convention here. So this is an equivalence relation. All right. And we're going to define something else here also. Because, again, our model is involving things being equal, but also things being element of, so we want to have something to do with the element of relation. So we will say F is an element of G, I guess, almost everywhere, and that's exactly what it will be. Is this exactly sort of the expected thing? Again, F is an element of G almost everywhere. That's not an equivalence relation, but it satisfies what we want an element of things to satisfy generally. Okay. So let me continue over here. Okay. We want to be able to collapse this x to the n because it's too big, and so this is how we're going to do it. So remember again that x consists of all the different xn's for natural n. So we'll start with x0, and we'll say, we'll start by defining y0 to be x0 mod the equivalence relation. So we're just equating, as we said, equating all the things that are equal almost everywhere. All the functions are equal almost everywhere. Okay, so then what we'll say is, let y be the superstructure over the ground set y0. And what I mean by that is, essentially, we do the same technique that we started with for x. For x0 to get x, do the same thing for y0. So y0, y1 being the set of all subsets, and so on and so on. And then the big y, the final set y, will be the collection of all of those together. Okay, now we're going to define a collapsing function, so called the Mostovsky collapsing function. So it goes from, I think I did something wrong there. Yeah, this was, sorry, that was bad. Okay, let's try that again. This was, we're taking all the functions and modding out by the equivalence relation. That was what I meant, and it doesn't work otherwise. Okay, and in general, we're going to have this collapsing function, going into y. Okay, this function is defined by, so it's equal to the equivalence class of f, that is if f is a sequence in x0 in the ground set. That's just, they just send it to its equivalence class. But if not, I'll do it this way, if not, then it's going to be a set, and we'll write this out and we'll see what we get here. For any function which is the point here is, if f is in the ground set, then we just send it to its equivalence class. If it's in some higher part of the superstructure, or if some of its elements are in a higher part of the superstructure, some of the elements in the sequence, then we kind of take the collection of everything that's in it almost everywhere, and create that as its object. So there's a point to where this is going. We're gonna use that. Now that we've collapsed, our set of sequences, we can now create a map from the original superstructure into the new superstructure, which is going to be the extension that we want. So here's our star map. Okay, so we're going to define the star map, which goes from the capital X to the capital Y. So from one superstructure to the extended superstructure, this is the non-standard extension map. And, yeah, so star X, we'll leave out the brackets, we'll write it as a raised star all the time, that's how it is generally. And it is the okay, so we basically write out a sequence of x's and then collapse it using the Mostovsky collapsing function. That's what the non-standard extension map does. And then we can say we call the ultra power this is the image of X under the star map, the extension map. Okay. So remember, these become equivalence classes of sequences or whatever. We'll see. Well, we'll discuss some of the properties of this non-standard extension map. Okay, so it is injective. But it's not onto. And not surjective. I'll show an example. Well, it's pretty easy because we can let y equal this sequence. Now, this sequence has no x that maps onto it through star. This is where it's essential that we started with a non-principal ultra filter. The point is there's no way that anything with all x's can be equal to, or there's no way that any sequence where all the elements are the same can be equal to this thing almost everywhere. And that's where it's necessary that the ultra filter is non-principal. Otherwise, you could have a thing in the ultra filter with only one element, and then it would be equal. So this is an example of where there is no. Well, this is an example of a y in here, or technically it's the equivalence class of this thing that is in the capital Y. Okay, not quite right. But there's no x that maps onto this thing. So the star map is not onto. What I meant to say then, this is not the same as. Oh. Well, this is a subset of Y, I guess is what I'm saying, and this is not onto Y. And then, okay, my point is, I suppose, that this is a subset but not equal to Y. Is that reasonable? The ultra should be the whole thing? Oh, I see. Pardon? Right. I see what you're saying. I'm not sure how much difference it really makes. I'm probably not going to use the term that much afterwards. So it's just a matter of definition. I mean, the point is that this is not the same as this. Sorry, pardon? Yeah. I guess it should be. So it's not exactly the image under star, right? No, wait a minute. Okay, so I guess my definition, it doesn't quite work completely. Once the image, I should say this is just the image of M, you mean? Yeah. Okay, it doesn't matter a whole lot, I guess. It's a subtle point there. Okay, I'm not sure. I don't think it matters. Really. Okay. And I should point out, what was the p- part of the, yeah, I should say also that y is, no, let me move over here. Okay. This y that I've written down here is actually in star r. Now, what that means is, from the definition somewhere, the point is, because each element in the sequence is a real number, so by this definition, and in fact, even if they weren't all real, but as long as they were almost all real, you'd have star r becomes, the set of sequences, or the collapse of the set of sequences, so that as long as they're almost all reals in the sequence. So I guess that's part of the point of what I'm saying. So y is in star r, but y is not the map of any, y is not the image of any particular real number mapping onto here. So that's how we see that there are real, what we're going to end up calling non-standard real numbers in the set star r. Okay, and we call this the hyperreal, the set of hyperreals. Okay. When we're talking about individual numbers and mapping things over with the star function, we leave out the star. So star x, we just call x. We identify with x, sort of. That is specifically for individuals. It's harder to do that for sets because you get in trouble if you try to do that for sets because they're always the same. For individuals, you can do that because nothing goes wrong. Again, the star x is just a set of all x's, and you collapse it. For individuals, that's okay. Okay, so let's add in a few more definitions here. Okay, if y is star x for some x, then we call y is called an extended standard entity. I'm putting extended in brackets because the point is that we can identify all the standard entities from whence it came. If that's right. So that's for y essentially in the range of the star, in the image of the star function. All right. Now, if y is an element of star x for some x, okay. So we don't know whether this means y itself is the image of a star for some other, for something. But if y is no star, then we call it internal. An internal entity. Okay. If it's an extended standard entity, then it is internal. Because if it's equal to the star map, then it's automatically in whatever this x, any set that the x was in. So the x star is, I should use different letters here. If y is equal to star x, and x is in z, then star x will be in star z. That's not totally obvious yet because I haven't stated the Leibniz transfer principle, but when I do, then it will be. So it will follow that any extended standard entity is internal, but not necessarily the other way around. And not the other way around in general. I guess I gotta start erasing. Start from the beginning. Okay. Oh, I could have said that at the bottom here. Anything, if it's not internal, then it's external. Well, anyway. We call it anything that's not an internal set is an external set. Okay. And just another notational comment. For any set, anything that's not in the ground, anything not in the ground, in the ground set, than any of the other subsets, that what we call the discrete standard part, is just, discrete standard part of A is we give it the symbol sigma A, and what it is it's the star X's for any X in the set. So that's very different than taking star A, because star A can include other new things, non-standard elements that do not come, that are not images of particular X's on the in the ground in the original superstructure. So this is saying we just take each element of A, map it using the star map and form that collection. In general, this set is not the star image of anything, so this set will generally be an external set. Okay. Alright. Let me use a couple more definitions. I guess I can just erase this one, right? Okay. So I'm going to get to the statement of the Leibniz-Chantre principle, and so a couple of definitions first. A statement is said to be is in standard bounded form if all the quantifiers are bounded using elements from our superstructure. They're all bounded using elements of X. What that means is you can have statements like, statements such as, well, these are similar things that have come up before in lectures and stuff, but you can have all X in A something, or there exists a Y in B something where A and B are in our superstructure X. Those are the only kinds of things we're going to be talking about. So, all right, we want this, what we're going to call the star transform. The star transform of a statement is the original statement, only basically every thing gets a star in front of it. So every element that we're taking from our system gets a star put in front of it. Applied the star map, has a star map applied to it. Star transform of a statement psi, where the statement is in standard bounded form to begin with. Otherwise, you can't do this. Alright, so is the statement star phi obtained by applying star to each individual or entity in the statement in phi. I'm just, this isn't really necessary all the time, but I'm distinguishing again between individual and entity, where individual is an element of the ground set x0, and the entities are the subsets. It wasn't really necessary to do that, but in some cases it might be. In any event, that's not significant here. What's important is, okay, the star transform gives us a statement with a bunch of stars in it. So it's a statement about the extended superstructure Y, which we get from an original statement about the original superstructure X. Okay. The Leibniz transfer principle. Okay. There's two parts. The Leibniz transfer principle, part A, I guess, says that, all right, so that the star, this the star map from X to Y, okay, it's an injection, we already know that, but it has the following property. So the property is any sentence that is true in the original model any sentence about A in standard bounded form is satisfied if and only if its star transform is also satisfied. Its star transform is satisfied or holds in Y. This, of course, structure. Okay, that's really part A. Part B, there is actually a general statement to part B, but I'm not going to be as general as I could be. I'll just talk about a specific case, but part B is that any infinite set is sort of expanded by the star transform. So, for infinite set A, star A, I guess we'll use this to mean cardinality, right? Is bigger than the cardinality of A. We sort of saw an example of that before. The real numbers, I guess it's off the board now. The star reals is a bigger set than the original real. That is to say, there are elements of the star real set which are hyperreals that are not mapped directly from the reals. Actually, this says more than that, but it follows from this that what we said before was true, although we proved that before anyway, from the specific example. Okay. All right, so let me give some examples of what we can do with the Leibniz transfer principle. In particular, let's examine the star natural numbers. And we'll find out what the star natural numbers look like. Okay, so this is a proposition. Any element of the hyper Hypernaturals? Yeah, hypernaturals, right. Any element of the hypernaturals is either standard, which means it comes from a specific natural number to begin with, which means we would call it sigma n. It's in the direct map of individual sigmas, right? Or unlimited. And I haven't defined that yet, but what I mean by unlimited is to say that n is bigger than m for any standard natural number. So what we have here is, the picture is more or less obvious. We're starting with the ordinary natural numbers that we usually know of, and then at the top you've got all these extra non-standard natural numbers, which are bigger than all the ordinary natural numbers. The point of this statement is there are no other hypernatural numbers stuck in between the ordinary natural numbers. Okay? And the proof is pretty easy using the Leibniz transfer principle. So, alright, so suppose the second case doesn't hold, we want to show the first case holds. So suppose that we have a natural number that is limited, that is to say, our natural number n is less than m for our hypernatural number n is less than m for some standard natural number m. All right. Well, we can write down the statement. How does this go? For all naturals, x is less than m. Implied. Now, this is a bit tricky, but it's valid because we're talking about a finite number of cases. Hold on. So we write down this statement. We've fixed m because we're saying that our natural number is smaller than a specific m. So we just write down this disjunction of all these statements. X equals 0, x equals m. This is finitely many statements, so we can actually write them down. This is a statement which is true. Right, if x is less than m, for ordinary natural, it's true in the ground model x. If x is less, if any number less than m, it's got to be one of those. I guess this could be n minus one. Oops. Well, anyway, this is a true statement in the ground model. So by the Leibniz transfer principle, we can star everything in the statement, and that means we star this and. We star these, but the numbers don't need to be starred, so nothing else changes. And we end up with what we want, that is to say, any star natural number, if it's less than the specific m, then it must be one of these specific standard numbers. So we can't have any non-standard hyperreal numbers that are sort of stuck between the ordinary standard natural numbers. Sorry, we can't have any hypernatural numbers that are stuck between the ordinary natural numbers. Okay, so in general, maybe I should move this up so we don't lose all this. I'll go. Okay, another proposition. Okay, star n looks like, or we'll say it basically appears to be the same as, n followed by uncountably many. Uncountably many copies of the integers, and so what we've shown already is that it's n and then something possibly, and what we're saying is that the extra stuff up here, the hypernaturals, consists simply of a whole bunch of copies of z, sort of one after the other. I don't have. well, this isn't the exact truth, but the basic idea is, there's several steps to. Yes. Not what? No, what did I say? Okay, no, order type. Yeah. I guess I should say that. Okay, I guess that's what we need to say. Well, in a way, the addition sort of works that way also. Yeah, I suppose so. Okay. Right, but if you add, okay, but if you add elements, if you add any elements, any standard natural number to one of these higher copies of Z, you stay within that copy of Z, according to the integral. So yeah, right, okay. Again, this can be built up using several applications of the Leibniz transfer principle, proving different facts sort of one at a time. This is sort of the big final conclusion that you end up with on that. So again, yeah, the idea is we have this. This part is what we would call the sigma n, and then this part is the rest of it, which we can think of. Well, we can say it's star n minus sigma n, and I'm saying that looks like uncountably many copies of Z of the integers. Okay. And also, this particular set of standard, the set of standard natural numbers, as I said before, in general, these sigma sets tend to be, are usually external, and in this case it is, and so is the other one. Again, that's another Leibniz transfer principle argument. You can say, if this were an internal set, then you'd have a statement that there's something in the star n set that's bigger than everything in it, and if you transfer that back to the X model, you'd end up saying there's a natural number bigger than every natural number, which is not true. So that's the contradiction for that one. And then this one is external just because complements are preserved under internal. If this were internal, this would have to be internal, and it isn't. Okay. Let me just do kind of another, well, just a specific example, which is sort of trivial, but it's a little bit maybe amusing, I don't know. Okay. So let B be the set of prime numbers. And we can write that as, all right, so we're going to want to write it using our, so it's a set of numbers in N. So we are ordinary natural numbers right now, okay. Instead of natural numbers, and the way we're going to write the property for prime numbers, so for any two natural numbers, if they're both greater than 1 but less than p, then they cannot multiply to give p. Otherwise, we have a factorization of p, right? So that means that a times b is not p. All right, so this is a set of natural numbers. We're going to star it, and using the Leibniz transfer principle, we get that we have our new set B star, which is elements of hypernaturals, so that for anything in there, those are all bound. That's it, right? Okay, so we have a new set of what we might call hyperprime numbers or something like that. But the point of this is that we get a set, this is, we know that of course that the prime numbers to begin with are infinite. So by part B of the Leibniz transfer principle, this new set has to have more elements than the original set B, which means there are some hyperfinite prime numbers, or unlimited prime numbers, or I guess numbers satisfying the equivalent of the prime condition, which is to say that there are no two numbers smaller than them, other than other than itself and one, that can multiply to give that hyperfinite number. For whatever that's worth, just kind of a little bit trivial. Anyway, just as a general summary of this piece so far, what we have is, well, not really summary, just a comment, to just be careful about the notation, because things can be confusing with the symbols. The power set of star n contains star, the power set of n, contains sigma power set of n, and these three are all different. The inclusions are strict. So this would mean take all ordinary standard subsets of n, and just, that's what this is, just copy them over. This would be take the set of standard subsets of n and star it, so you get extra things in the set when you move the set over to the new structure. And this would be take the original set of natural numbers and star it, so you get all your hypernatural numbers, and then take all the subsets within your within the extended superstructure, all the subsets of the hypernatural numbers. So we've got three different sets going on here. And they are all different. These are all strict inclusions. Okay. Let's look at... maybe if we can get rid of that. Okay, so we've looked at the natural numbers, or the hypernatural numbers a little bit. Let's look at the hyperreals, because after all, that's kind of what all of a lot of this stuff is about, or all the real non-standard analysis ends up being about. Okay. So we'll look at the hyperreals, and we'll put some definitions here. So a number R is either finite or limited if it's bounded by M for some standard M. Okay, otherwise it's unlimited. And we talked about unlimited hypernaturals before, but anyway. So it's limited in this case, or else it's unlimited in the other case. We talk about big O is a set of limited scalars, or limited numbers. And it would be nice to get an idea of what this set looks like. Just as an example of something that's not in big O, if you take the equivalence class of this sequence, right, that's not in big O. And again, because we're talking about non-principal alter filters, there's no way this can be equal almost everywhere to something that is... Oh, I didn't define the less than properly. I missed that. Okay, the less than, that would be a problem. Okay, less than... all right, A is less than B for these standard real numbers. It's the usual thing if A is less than B almost everywhere. I mean, it's the obvious thing. The point is, because this is an unbounded sequence, it can't be less than anything almost everywhere. Okay. I didn't say that clearly before, but that we've got it here now. So this actually, it doesn't really need to be stated explicitly. It follows from starring the less than operation, which is really what this is. so we're okay on that. Anyway, okay, yeah. This is an example of an unlimited hyperreal. The other example that probably isn't on the board anymore, where we had a sequence that kind of converged to zero. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, well, okay. That was an example we call infinitesimal, and let me write the definition down. So, infinitesimal, we say delta is infinitesimal. It actually took me a while to realize that there are four I's in this word. There's an I in here. Infinitesimal. Delta is infinitesimal if it's less than one. If we can say if it's less than 1/n for all standard natural numbers, meaning that the ordinary, it's a number that doesn't satisfy the ordinary Archimedean property for real numbers. Normally, any real number, no matter, well, we know there are no real numbers that satisfy this. The point is, if a hyperreal does satisfy this, we call it an infinitesimal. And there are infinitely many of these infinitesimals sort of clustered right around zero. And we use the symbol A is approximately B. Oh, I forgot to write. Well, just a second. If A minus B is in the set little o, and that's the point is that little o is the set of all infinitesimals. Little o, not to be confused with big O, which was the all limited scalars. Little o, something like that. Okay, yeah, so we write this to say that these are essentially, we say they're infinitely close together because they differ only by an infinitesimal. Okay, so if we ask the question of what do the star real, the hyperreal, set of hyperreal numbers look like, what it amounts to is you basically have your set of all, you take all the real numbers, the ordinary standard real numbers, and around each real number there's sort of a cloud or a cluster of things that are infinitesimally close to it. So every hyperreal number consists of, or I should say to be precise, every limited hyperreal number has a standard part, that is, a standard real number that it's infinitesimally far away, it's infinitesimally close to. Let me write something. Let's see. I'll bring this one back. Whatever. Okay. All right. So for any, I guess, R hyperreal, okay, we can write R equals, I'm going to use a letter, P plus I, where P is some standard real and I is some infinitesimal. And the point is, that our star system of hyperreals consists of all the reals with a cluster of things infinitesimally close to each one. Sorry, that was all the limited real. Oh yeah, okay. All okay. This is wrong. This is all in limited. This is the big O. So all the limited scalars, all the limited or finite real numbers have this property. If we want to be formal, just to sort of complete, you know, make this a little bit nicer, we can talk about, this sounds a little bit confusing, but it's not really once we see what's going on. We can talk about plus or minus infinity. We can add them in to extend the standard real number system. I know it sounds weird because we're extending things all over the place, but if we just replace the real numbers with the, you know, minus infinity to plus infinity, including the endpoints, then, you know, if we call this R, it's a little bit strange to do that, but let me give it another name. Well, forget the name. Basically, we can say for any hyperreal number, okay, R is P plus I, where P is in sigma R union plus or minus infinity, and I is an infinitesimal. That should work. Yeah, you know what? Actually, I think that's not quite right. Okay, let's leave that back to the way it originally was. I think, sorry, the generalization was supposed to be, yeah, this doesn't quite generalize as simply as I was writing down there. What it was meant to be is every... Just a second. The generalization is supposed to be that every, that if you add on negative and positive infinity, every hyperreal has a standard part, which may be negative or positive infinity. Now that should mean that what I was writing there is true, but that doesn't, maybe that's not totally right, so maybe I should check that later or something. Okay, I'm not... if we consider the real thing... What did you say? It's not a field anymore because why? Well, but they aren't on this set either, right?
No, they're not. But I mean, one of the interests of the extension of star R is that it remains to be the field, which is the part of the field extension. That's important.
Yeah. I better check that later. Yeah, no, okay. It's okay. No, I see there's a problem. I'll have to leave that for later or something. Because there's something supposed to be nicer by adding the plus or minus infinity, and I might have got that slightly wrong about what it is exactly. Okay, well, anyway. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right, so let me say something about non-standard, this hyperfinite descriptive set theory, although I don't really have that very much to say about it. No, I can never read anything here. I'll just start with a couple of definitions and see what happens. Okay. The basic idea is when we've done descriptive set theory, we've always talked about, building out the Borel hierarchy and the analytic projective hierarchy, starting with open sets and so on. So in non-standard descriptive set theory, there are ways to define similar hierarchies, but with a different starting point. Right. So we can take F to be an infinite hyperfinite set. Alright, we're going to define our sets like this. So first the Borel hierarchy. So the sigma 0, 0 of S is going to be the same as the pi 0, 0 of S. And it's just the internal sets, the internal subsets of S. Okay. All right. Then that's our starting point. From then on, it's basically similar to the ordinary descriptive set theory. we just say that for any alpha, so for alpha less than omega 1, right, for countable alpha, this is this set of accounts, what do we say, countable unions, right? Countable unions of subsets of whatever we had before, or the pi of whatever was before. Okay, and then, of course, as we define the pi's, is just complements of the way we, what we would expect, complements of the sigmas. Okay, and then again, the Borel, the, what we call the Borel set, is the union of all the sigma zero alphas, just as it would have been. Okay, then the projective set. Okay, so that's the real hierarchy. We want to define the projective hierarchy. So we start with sigma 1, 1. All right, it's a set of projections of sets. Which are, let's see, Borel set over S cross T for some hyperfinite T. And then the usual things after that, more or less. So sigma 1 n plus 1 for natural n. Set of set B such that, well, okay. Yeah, for some hyperfinite T, B is projective B is the projection on S of a set A of some set in the previous levels of a set A in pi 1n of S cross T. Okay, and as usual, the pi's are just the complements. And finally, I left out the fact that the deltas are the, you know, well, they always are. Intersections of both. Sigma intersection pi, and same thing here. And so these all together are all the projective sets. Or analytic. Yeah, sorry. And one interesting result is that it turns out that even though this definition requires any hyperfinite set T, it turns out that we can fix this set before we start, and it doesn't change the definition. I don't have a proof of that now, but that can be proven. I mean, that has been proven. Those are the definitions we get for the non-standard descriptive set theory, and there are some results that are similar to the standard version, and some results that are different. I don't have much more in particular, that's kind of the end of my notes that I have written down, so I think I'm done.